From North Dakota to South Carolina, Maine to Arizona, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, as the 2024 presidential campaign enters its final week, religion has emerged as a key factor. Timothy Head from the Faith and Freedom Coalition joins us with analysis. Campaign 2024 is in its closing days, and the presidential candidates are making their final pitches to voters. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story. Donald Trump has promised to end taxes on tips, Social Security, and overtime. But Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains the need to talk more about cutting spending. And all this talk about protecting democracy is nonsense. We live in a constitutional republic, not a democracy. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College gives us a civics lesson on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Aside from the war between Israel and Hamas, religion hasn't been much of a factor in the 2024 presidential race. But two recent missteps by Kamala Harris has put religion back in the spotlight. Timothy Head is executive director of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. He joins us now to discuss. Tim, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Tim, throughout this presidential campaign, faith and religion, aside from the conflict in the Mideast, hasn't really played a big role. But in the last couple of weeks, we've had Kamala Harris telling a protester who shouted, "Jesus is Lord," that he was at the wrong rally. We've had her not going to the L. Smith dinner. What impact do you think these really anti-Christian views are having on this campaign?
The "Jesus is Lord" kind of snafu by Kamala harkens, I think, a lot of us back to Hillary Clinton's seemingly quick or sudden flip of the tongue when she referred, you know, in kind of a closed door setting to Christians or evangelicals being irredeemable and a basket of deplorables. It seems like that was just kind of one quick phrase or kind of turn of hand. Honestly, things like that, a lot of voters, period, especially a lot of religious voters, feel like that's it's kind of a peak, a moment of clarity or honesty. And I think that that actually ends up becoming pretty viral and really kind of saturates a lot of the market. So clearly her positions, her policy positions, are not terribly biblical, we'll just say, in nature. But then whenever she actually starts making comments like, "Hey, you Christian, you're in the wrong place," and the rest of the crowd erupts in ovation, I think a lot of people paid attention to that and really do remember it.
This seems to be an ongoing theme. Do you also recall former President Obama claiming that we're based here in Pennsylvania, claiming that those of us in Pennsylvania cling to guns and religion? Seems to be a strain of, if not anti-religion, trying to push religion off to the side among Democrat candidates. Is this part of their effort to really replace religion with the state as being the primary focus of life?
Certainly that's been the approach of communist and socialist regimes for the last 100 years, 80 to 100 years, is precisely that, like explicitly. You know, that's actually part of the communist manifesto. But ironically, we've seen more and more of that play out, both in rhetoric and in policy and in governance, from the political left. That's probably not been the case, really. You know, going back to the 70s and even 80s and 90s, they were not quite as hostile. The policies probably diverted from biblical teaching, but at least the party wasn't hostile. But like the DNC in 2008, the convention where they removed any mention of Jerusalem and of God from the party platform pretty memorably or historically. And then you just alluded to Obama's kind of rhetoric and, you know, certainly carrying forward in really the last three other candidates in Clinton, Biden, and now Kamala. It's pushing farther and farther and farther away and ostracizing people of faith more and more and more.
Yeah, at one point, we can all recall former President Jimmy Carter, certainly a man of faith. He's a Sunday school teacher and continued to very late in his life to be a Sunday school teacher. Democrats were also embracing a faith. John F. Kennedy, of course, was the first Catholic to be elected president. Now we see that Kamala Harris doesn't even attend the L. Smith dinner. Isn't that function really supposed to be a nonpartisan event here, Tim, where candidates get together, sort of make fun of themselves, and we try to maybe lighten up the conversation a little bit?
That's definitely the case. I think a lot of the viewers and listeners of yours know that it's formatted basically as a roast of one another. And you're right, it can be lighthearted, and the money that gets raised there is it's certainly kind of a Catholic fixture. But the kinds of things that the money goes towards are pretty widely accepted and agreed upon, education, kind of some charitable work, things of that nature. And so really to not show up there, it really strains a lot of people's curiosity. It's like, why would you be so wanting to distance yourself that aggressively from anything that's even remotely associated with faith-based programming? And frankly, I know some people that were in the room that actually said even a lot of Democrats from New York City and the metro area there were super, super turned off and very offended by that. And ironically, Trump performed pretty well just that night. Like, in living color, he was approachable and just kind of affable through the process.
Former President Trump has, on the campaign trail, Tim, expressed some concern about voter turnout among Christians. And from your point of view, you work in a lot of areas here with the various groups of faith. What is happening this year? Are Christians engaged in this election?
They're actually very engaged. So the largest single constituency in all of American politics, on the political right or the left, remains the evangelical vote, generally 26-27% of the entire electorate, not Republican, the entire electorate will be self-identified evangelical, and probably about another 9 or 10% will be Catholic voters this cycle, and that's held pretty accurate for about the last 35 to 40 years. And interestingly enough, these are kind of early returns right now, but strong turnout already among faith-based voters, evangelicals and Catholics particularly. And I think as the contrast, if you will, between the parties and the candidates has become more and more stark, the decision becomes easier and easier, despite the media trying to kind of like drive a wedge between pro-life, pro-family candidates and evangelical voters. The voters still are responding to pro-life, pro-faith, pro-family, and pro-Israel policies and campaigns.
You mentioned Israel. The Democrat Party also seems to have a problem with the Jewish vote this year. They've tried to have it both ways on the whole Israel-Hamas situation. Do you see them as sending a mixed message on that front to Jewish voters of faith?
I'll be honest, I don't even know that it's a mixed message at this point. I mean, frankly, not only are right-leaning Jewish voters, clearly they have all of the reasons that they need, but even a lot of left-leaning voters who may be kind of like fiscally conservative but more socially liberal or moderate have just been appalled at the activity and rhetoric by the Democrat Party and frankly just the Biden White House since October 7th of 2023. And despite many, many appeals, both to support Jews here in the United States against anti-Semitism and then also certainly to support the nation of Israel, at best, you would say the Biden-Harris administration has been ambivalent, and frankly, at worst, it's even actually been hostile to Israel and pro-Israel, pro-Jewish activity that so many people have been calling for.
We have been talking with Timothy Head, and Tim is executive director of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. Tim, tell us a bit about the Faith and Freedom Coalition. Also, where can folks go to learn more about your organization?
Find us and follow us at ffcoalition.com is our website. We exist just to, simply put, to give Christians a voice in government. So we're lobbying state legislatures in Washington, D.C. on pro-life, pro-family, pro-faith messaging and policies. And then we're informing and then mobilizing evangelical and Catholic voters across the country.
Timothy Head of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. Tim, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. God bless.
Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. He's been monitoring the presidential campaign for us all year. It's time for the candidates to make their closing arguments. Scott, usually candidates end their campaigns not on a negative note, but on an aspirational note. We're not seeing that from Kamala Harris and the Democrats. Want to give us your take on the closing arguments of the presidential candidates?
Well, we're less than 2 weeks out from the election. And, you got Trump and Harris barnstorming all across America, hitting up the swing states, giving high-profile interviews and speeches, trying to reach other disconnected and forgotten voters and run up the early vote counts as much as they can, because obviously they'll want to keep counting ballots after Election Day, right? But I think it's interesting because the Harris campaign is trying to throw stuff up against the wall and see if anything will stick against Trump. And if you remember this in 2016, and I think to a degree in 2020, no matter how Trump was attacked he can basically shed any of those attacks off fairly easily and flip the script. This week, we heard the Democrats say that Trump's a fascist, and they rolled out his former chief of staff, John Kelly, saying that Trump praised Hitler. And now they're comparing Trump to Hitler. And then they bring out new sexual allegations of groping from a former model that was introduced to him by Jeffrey Epstein. And I think that it's this desperation of Kamala Harris to try to mix the message away from her record and hope that American people will fall for the trap and take the bait on something controversial and hope that there's this October surprise. But the reality is that all this fake nonsense that they're putting out there, you know, starting with John Kelly, it's been refuted by, you know, Mark Meadows and Nick Ayers, who is Mike Pence's chief of staff. Other senior officials in the Trump administration have said, of course, he didn't say this. And then you had the situation where he apparently disparaged the murdered veteran. And I just think that this is ultimately the Democrats really in panic mode. And when you look at the Trump campaign, he's having fun. He was at the drive-thru with McDonald's. He's, you know, just out there in a way that people kind of appreciate. And when Donald Trump gets back to the message of the Biden administration has ruined the economy, the Biden administration has let over 10 to 15 million illegal aliens cross the border, making crime higher, making you less safe and secure. And then you look at the forever war positions of Kamala Harris campaigning alongside everybody's least favorite neocon, Liz Cheney, that ultimately it's going to backfire on the Democrats. And Trump is headed to a big, big win. I think he's going to get over 320 electoral votes. And he's going to do that by not just winning states that he lost last time from Georgia and North Carolina, Pennsylvania, but he's also going to be, I think, picking up places like Nevada, Arizona, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Maybe he doesn't sweep every single one of those states, right? We know that these are close. We know that they're going to come down to a few thousand votes here and there in some of these bellwether counties. But the message to suburban voters, I think, has been pretty solid. One of the big ads that's out there that the Trump campaign is running in swing states is that Trump is for you, but Harris is for they, them. And they have elevated this issue of men competing in girls' sports and social issues that I think really concern a lot of parents in schools. School choice is still a big issue. We all learned our lesson, I think, during COVID to the indoctrination that's happening front and center with kids. But, you know, ultimately the economy, immigration, those are big, big issues that the Trump campaign is going to win on because they're right on the policies and Kamala is desperate.
Speaking of desperation, it's interesting in a couple of these swing states, we also have U.S. Senate races that have become very highly competitive, especially in the states of Michigan and Pennsylvania. Interesting, Scott, that the Democrat candidates are now praising their cooperation with Donald Trump in their advertising. Is that sort of a bellwether as well?
It's fascinating because you're fighting over this group of undecided voters in the middle. It's not like somebody that's a radical leftist is still considering whether to vote for the Democrat. And I think it's the same thing on the far right. You know, they're pretty much locked in with the America First MAGA conservative vote that is for Trump. But there are independent voices that want to see candidates for the U.S. Senate work across the aisle. And these independent voters are receiving a message in Pennsylvania right now from Bob Casey that he agrees with Trump, that he wants to, you know, fight back against China. And then they're receiving a similar message in Michigan from Alyssa Slotkin, who I think is a crazed liberal just as much as any of the rest of them. But they're trying to appeal to independent voters right now. And when you know that this is a 1 or 2% race, that's the, I think the smart play by some of these consultants. My hope is that voters actually look at records and Bob Casey and Alyssa Slotkin in Michigan, those two have a number of far left votes that really reveal where their allegiance is and how far the Democrat Party has also shifted. If you think about where the political middle was, it has definitely gone to the left over the last 16 years since Barack Obama won in 2008. And, you know, a lot of people have to wonder if they're going to be comfortable with that. I think that's why you have sort of like a traditional Reagan Democrat coming out for Donald Trump along the Rust Belt, especially, you know, states like Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, that he did so well in 2016, but not so well in 2020. Those are the big questions. We've also got huge, huge voter turnout efforts right now. You and I have a mutual friend, Cliff Maloney, who's running the PA chase to try to get people registered in Pennsylvania. Well, voter registration just closed. They finished that work. And now it's all about making sure that people show up and cast their ballot, early voting, mailing it in, or voting on election day.
And Scott, also in the upper Midwest, we have quite a pitched battle for a U.S. Senate seat in Wisconsin. How is that shaping up?
Well, there you have a career politician, Tammy Baldwin, who, again, is another one of these far-left senators. She's been in office, I think, since 1996, serving in the House and then serving the last couple of terms in the U.S. Senate. She was a longtime Madison City Councilwoman and just really representing what the progressive base is from Wisconsin. And she's running against a businessman, Eric Hovde. Hovde's sort of had a lot of fun with his campaign. He's got a lot of real momentum, and it gives us a shot to, you know, not only have a couple of Senate pickups when it comes to Montana and West Virginia, which we previously discussed, but also to start picking up some seats. Maybe we pick up Wisconsin. Maybe we pick up Nevada or Arizona. Maybe we do well, and we actually win with Dave McCormick in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. These races are so close. And so the final stretch, the final message that candidates are giving voters, it really does matter. But I would also remind all these candidates and remind voters to remember what the message of the last 18 months has been about and not to fall for any misinformation that might come out right at the end.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. As always, Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is based in Washington, D.C., boasting over 525,000 members from all 50 states in the country. And you can check us out at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Well, Scott, down to the last week. We'll talk to you again then. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Donald Trump has promised to cut a wide range of taxes, but there is no talk about cutting spending, and there should be. We learn more from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
During a town hall event at a barber shop in the Bronx earlier this week, former President Donald Trump was asked about the possibility of eliminating the federal income tax. And his answer, I think, reveals something about what Trump understands about fiscal policy, and also, maybe more importantly, something that he doesn't seem to quite grasp. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. Trump was at that event at the barbershop in the Bronx for a Fox News town hall this week. Yeah, for real, at a barbershop in the Bronx, wild stuff. And honestly, kudos to his campaign for demonstrating this willingness to think outside the box on some of these things. Of course, just last weekend, there was that brilliant moment where Trump was working the French fry machine in the drive-thru window at that McDonald's in the Philly suburbs. And I mean this sincerely. I think his campaign has done a terrific job of kind of rethinking the way presidential campaigns work and getting out there, doing outreach and doing events that sort of put Trump in front of audiences that are different from that of a typical presidential campaign. It's been really successful. And at that event in the Bronx, one of the questions that Trump took was about whether he would support the elimination of the federal income tax. And of course, the context here is that Trump has already called for exempting a lot of income from that tax, including income from tips and from Social Security payments. And as I've discussed on this program before and written at Reason, yeah, I'm a little bit skeptical about whether any of those things will actually come to pass. A lot of it would require congressional approval, and there's a lot of fiscal decisions there to be made. But regardless, Trump has supported these things. And so he was asked whether he would also support just a full elimination of the federal income tax. Here's a little snippet of what he said in response.
You know, in the old days, when we were a smart country, in the 1890s and all, this is when the country was relatively the richest it ever was. It had all tariffs. It didn't have an income tax.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now we have income taxes, and we have people that are dying. They're paying tax, and they don't have the money to pay the tax. No, in the old days, 1890, 1880. We had so much money, they had to set up committees, blue ribbon committees, how to spend our wealth. We had no idea how to spend it with so much money. Then we went to the income tax system, and the rest is sort of history.
Now, as a libertarian, I have to applaud this impulse. The income tax sucks. It sucks. It's a real burden that creates a disincentive to work and unfairly robs productive Americans of their earnings. And Trump is right. There was a time when the country didn't have an income tax. There was a very small income tax originally created to fund the Civil War, but that was just temporary. And then the income tax, as we know it today, was created after the passage of the 16th Amendment in 1913. So I have to also applaud Trump for talking more about fiscal policy in this campaign than I expected that he would. He's promised to cut some taxes, as I've already discussed, and to raise others, of course, most notably tariffs, which are taxes on imported goods. Now, Trump being Trump, you know, I don't think he was being entirely serious when he made that comparison to the 1890s. But it is a useful illustration of the missing piece in his fiscal policy plans. See, if you want to cut the government's funding to 1890s levels and you want to use 1890s methods to get there, well, then you have to cut spending to 1890s levels, too. So where is the plan to do that? For that matter, where is any plan to cut spending? Realistically, of course, we're not going to cut the government back to 1890s levels, as much as I might like that. Measured as a share of GDP, federal spending in the 1890s was about 3%. In 2024, government spending equaled about 24% of GDP, so 7.5 times higher. Currently, America's GDP is about $28 trillion. So if you were to cut the government back to 1890s levels, then that would mean the government could spend no more than $900 billion next year. That's a big number, of course, $900 billion, but it pales in comparison to the $6 trillion that we spent this year. And even at that level, even at $900 billion, I'm not sure that tariffs would be able to fund the government entirely, as Trump suggested. It's also, you know, we should talk about how you would spend that $900 billion. Let's put it in context. Social Security alone cost $1.4 trillion this year. The interest on the existing national debt cost $890 billion this year. So you pay the bill on the debt, and then you're left with about $10 billion left to do everything else. So goodbye military, goodbye Social Security, goodbye Medicare, goodbye to all of that. You simply can't have 1890s tax policy and 2020s entitlement plans. You have to pick one. And again, look, I'd love to see the government spend less, a lot less. Trump is at least directionally correct here. But when the government is running a huge deficit, as it currently is, you can't just start cutting taxes until you also cut spending. There is a huge disconnect right now between the amount that the government, between the amount of government that Americans get and what they pay for. And closing that gap should be priority number one for any Republican, because it certainly won't be the Democrats that do it. So Trump needs a plan to cut spending, a real one, not just vague promises about reducing regulations or attacking waste, fraud, and abuse. That's all fine and good, but it doesn't get you very far. And until I see that plan or hear him talk about it a bit more, I'm going to remain kind of skeptical about these other tax policies that he's talking about. Because in Trump's first year in office, because in Trump's first term in office, he was not exactly a paragon of fiscal responsibility. He added $8 trillion to the debt in just 4 years, and much of that was before the pandemic hit. I also don't need Trump to roll us all the way back to the 1890s. I mean, heck, I would take the 1980s. When the government was running deficits that at the time looked huge, but were far more responsible than where we are at today. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out the rest of our coverage of the final stages of this year's presidential campaign and everything else that we're working on at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
We live in a constitutional republic, not a democracy. So all this talk about protecting democracy is fundamentally wrong. So says Dr. Paul Kengor, editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, on this American Radio Journal commentary.
One of the most annoying things in our impoverished public discourse, which frankly has been degraded by all sides, are the howls from liberals about democracy, and especially that Donald Trump will quote-unquote destroy democracy. That battle cry has become a literal yard sign in election year 2024, with Harris Walls supporters planting placards in their yards proclaiming simply decency, democracy. Okay, I get the decency part. They feel that Donald Trump is crude, belligerent. And, you know, to be honest, Trump since 2015, 2016 certainly has shown his vulgarity. But most annoying are the shouts, the screams that Donald Trump is going to destroy democracy. Most troubling about the charge is its emptiness, its vagueness. I've had exchanges with liberals about this, usually only via email because they get too emotional face to face. I attempt the dialogue by saying something like, okay, look, I know you detest Donald Trump. I understand your concern about him threatening decency and demeaning civil discourse. I get it. But please tell me specifically, how will Donald Trump destroy democracy? What typically follows is a litany aimed at the person of Trump, often sprinkled with added incendiary descriptions like fascist, Hitler, Mussolini. I plead, however, for specifics. I want to know how precisely a reelected Donald Trump would, quote unquote, destroy democracy. Would he somehow unilaterally end First Amendment freedoms, such as speech, press, assembly? How does a president do that? After a second and final term, would he barricade himself in the Oval Office with a group of Marines refusing to leave? Would he somehow cancel the November 2028 election once he was term limited out of office? How so? In these exchanges, I try to get my interlocutor to define democracy so we can better ascertain how Donald Trump will destroy it. That dialogue gets still worse when I explain to the person the United States of America is not, are you ready for this, a democracy. Yes, that's correct. As someone who has taught political science for three decades, perhaps I can add some light. The United States of America is a representative republic, defined by Merriam-Webster as a system in which, quote, power resides in a body of citizens entitled to vote and is exercised by elected officers and representatives responsible to them, unquote. More specifically, we're a constitutional republic, that is, a nation with a constitution that lays out our government structure, branches, division of powers, and our splendid system of checks and balances. Those brilliant checks and balances by the founders prevent the chief executive from destroying democracy. I suppose that because we have certain democratic values, we might be loosely labeled a representative democracy or a constitutional democracy. But what we are really is a representative constitutional republic. Now, here's a shocker for the destroying democracy crowd. The U.S. Constitution, are you ready for this? Doesn't use the word democracy or democratic even one time. That's right. Check it out yourself. Likewise, the word never appears in the Declaration of Independence. By contrast, representative or representation appears 21 times in the Constitution. In fact, the Constitution uses this description, quote, the United States shall guarantee to every state of the Union a republican form of government, unquote. So this surge among progressives describing us as a democracy is a further sign of civic illiteracy. We're a republic, folks. To borrow from Ben Franklin, our founders gave us a republic, if we can keep it. So regardless of how one feels about Donald Trump, he cannot destroy our democracy. He's conveniently being accused of destroying the very thing that the nation is not. When you encounter that nonsense, challenge it. The charge itself contributes to our declining discourse and decency. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliates, KBRT-AM and KNSN-AM in Costa Mesa, California. Welcome to our new listeners in the Golden State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.